This week's a great show, but in advance, we just wanted to warn you and let you know that we do talk about suicide with our guest. It's a serious subject that we're keen to talk openly about, but also we wanted to let you know that that content was in the show. If you are struggling with your mental health, please do reach out for help. Whether that be the Samaritans website, Movember's website, or Calm, there's a number of places where you can go and get support. Please do reach out for help. We hope you enjoy this week. As I said, it's a really fun episode, and whilst tackling some pretty heavy subject matter, we talk a lot about bikes and lots of other things as well. So listen on and enjoy.
Ben, it's time to introduce now. We all promise that we'll keep quiet, okay? Yeah. So Ben, do your best and try and keep it short.
Hello and welcome to The Knot. In this series, we'll be living our own values of riding and connecting with fellow bikers, breaking down barriers on the road and off the bikes. We'll be chatting with our guests about their love of riding, how it fits into and helps shape their lives, as well as how it can support and promote a positive conversation about all our mental health and well-being.
I don't want a pickle, just want to ride on my motorcycle.
We have struck out from the den of egos and stuffed them into our helmets to hit the road where we are all happiest. This week, we find ourselves tucked away out of the bitter cold rain in the beautiful Cotswolds with our guest who's flown in from LA to join us. Well, he's flown in, but we're probably not the main reason. He's here. A very warm welcome to Mark Shepherd.
Hi there, how you doing?
Mark Shepherd is a musician, actor, father, husband, and bike enthusiast and collector. From playing in front of 100,000 people supporting U2's Joshua Tree tour at Croke Park, through to 12 series in the hit show Supernatural, and some roles in Doctor Who and Battlestar Galactica, Mark has seen and done many things, and he has plenty of stories to tell. So, welcome, Mark. Let's get into it.
How are you? I'm doing well. A little tired, a little jet-lagged, but, you know, when you have to fly in for a podcast, that's just the chance you've got to take.
Being rich and famous.
I like the fact that in the job that I do, I'm not that famous. There's sort of degrees of fame. There's ways of looking at fame, which is, but you start out with, you get known, you're that guy.
Yeah.
And I have got to the stage where, are you Mark Shepherd, is the usual question. So that's kind of nice. So it's not, oh, you're that guy on that thing. Were you in that, you know, whatever.
But I think that's probably better. I'd rather be your level of famous than, say, Brad Pitt. Because if you want to go down the store to get some milk, Brad Pitt's not just walking out of this house and going down the shops again and pack of milk.
He is.
Without getting,
yeah, he does,
because
Los Angeles is the most diffident place in the world. Try being a comedian in L.A. and then getting an audience. I mean, nobody cares in L.A. Nobody. It's a weird thing. It's like London. There's a, you know, you're walking down the street in Soho and, you know, there's Ralph Fiennes going into Warner Brothers or whatever.
I think it's where you're going. If you're going to the Ivy for dinner up in town, then, you know, and then you get annoyed because people are taking photos of you, then, you know, that's not quite the right way to approach.
Fame is a really, really bizarre thing. It's, having left England quite young, I moved to Ireland, and then I was in bands in Ireland and all over the place, and then moved to America and then started my career not here. I was never an actor in England.
So are you saying that your career, you started off as a musician?
I was a musician. I was a professional musician. I did. I played in a band called the Television Personalities on Rough Trade. In 1980 was the first album I made. And then I played with Em and Nikki Sudden and a few other bands from that era. So, you know, bands that other bands covered and influenced other bands. And then I ended up playing with Robin Hitchcock. And then I ended up joining, after Robin, Robin had the Soft Boys. I joined Robin's band in 82, I think. And then I joined the Barracudas in 83. And so I was in these bands that traveled the world. I then came back, band disbanded, and I moved to Ireland, which is my father's, yeah, Dublin is my father's town. And so I had a lot of family there, and I moved over there as a 20, 21 years old. And that really became my spiritual home. That's like, you know, becoming politicized, becoming aware, becoming, you know, at a time in Ireland, which was absolutely fascinating.
It was massive change at that time.
Absolutely massive change.
And they were coming into the EU. Ireland was coming back, because I grew up there as a kid. And I mean, Ireland, was to a degree up until that point, was literally a third world country.
It was pretty rough back in the day, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I'm a plastic paddy. I was born in London. So, you know, it's like, it was slightly weird, dispossessed, but of my generation, you've got Shane McGowan and Billy Idol and Johnny Lydon and all those guys, Billy Duffy from Manchester, but sort of that sort of London Irish, Anglo Irish musician thing was actually a really big deal. But when I was in Dublin and band Light a Big Fire, everything changed. It went from being TV, you know, Gay Baron running the Late Show, and the Angelus bin on RTE2 at 6 o'clock at night. Bong, you know, when you have a hangover, it's the worst thing to wake up to. You know, it was my 2-bar electric fire, and I was saying, yeah, you know, my house got robbed by the General, and I mean, it was an interesting time.
But the General was this very famous thief in Ireland, and he actually, Dad made a film about it called The General.
Great film, one of my favorites.
People should go and see it, and then they'll know what we're talking about. But it was bizarrely, if you're robbed by the General, it was a kind of a badge of honor.
Absolutely, a badge. They stole my gas meter. So they've got a ladder.
And no shame.
No shame at all. But there's a wonderful thing about Ireland at that time, which is as a youth, there was just this incredible sense of hope. Jackie Charlton had taken over the Irish football team, and we beat England 2-1 in a football match, which had never happened. It was a part-time football team, basically, to that point.
He would write checks. And to get kit for his football team, and he would give the check, and
because he was so wealthy from winning the World Cup and just being,
he wasn't wealthy at all.
No, he wasn't wealthy at all. But he would write
checks never cash.
No, but they would never cash them. The shop wouldn't cash them, and they would frame them and put them up in the wall and say, you know, we supplied him with kit.
So the old days, you used to go on a pub anywhere in Ireland, you know that, you go down, you know, because I was playing in bands that reinvented the show band circuit. So one of my managers was Eamon Carr from the Horselips. So we were playing the same places, like Caesar's Palace, Bunclody, the Atlantic Ballroom, Ballybunion.
You know exactly what that is.
I know, you're pretty, but all of them.
The Blue Lagoon in Sligo. And I've played the Savoy in Limerick and all these great places, and Cork City Hall and all the great places to play. But it hadn't been played since the 70s. So we were playing these cow sheds and bringing it all back, and the hope and the idea of doing it. And curiously enough, when I was playing, it was unfortunately the worst of my drinking times. And it was the end of my drinking times at that time. And what was really interesting is the first time in my life, that period, when I didn't ride a motorcycle. I've never ridden a motorcycle in Ireland. Because I knew
you'd been riding before.
So 15 years old, a kid whose name I can't remember, obviously stole a bike, and I was too naive to realize it was a stolen bike, and left a Kawasaki Z650 at my house and said, just don't take it anywhere. So I just rode it up and down the street and learned how to change gears.
Don't take it anywhere. No, 10 minutes later.
This is a guy that showed up at my house one day in a BMW. He had obviously stolen, but I was too naive to realise he'd stolen it. You want to go for a drive? And I got on a drive, and he was driving around the North Circular at 120 miles an hour, seeing if it would go into second gear in the automatic. I was like, this is fun. I mean, I was wonderfully naive. I had, you know, a lot of villains around in those days. It was kind of fun. But there was a guy behind my garage who had an old 12-cylinder E-type Jag that he bought, and the engine was locked at top dead centre, so they thought it was wrecked, and it wasn't. And he brought it back and he did it. And in the back of that was a Gorelli 50.
That thing of the Gorelli was the responsibility of getting people on the bikes.
That was me. It had pedals attached to the top of the engine. It was like an afterthought.
See, I've never heard of a Gorelli. What's a Gorelli?
It's like, I suppose it was like a pedal and pop.
It wasn't like a Pooch Maxi. It was kind of cool before Fizzy came out and the rest of them came out. It had pedals for a kickstart. Where the shaft was, you actually had to like be up in the air to start it. And then it would run. It would flat out do about 55, 60 miles an hour. It was a great little bike.
Had your father ridden motorbikes? Was there any...
No, my dad...
What do you think that catalyst was for
freedom?
For getting
and
freedom.
I could see people's freedom. And there was a lot of sort of mods and rockers around at the time. So you figure I was born 64. So we're talking 78, 79, post-punk, yeah. Right in that first era of punk. And all the local guys were riding C15 BSAs, and they're all long-haired layabouts. And I had a shaved head back in those days.
Were you sort of into ska in those days? Or?
Well, my dad roomed with Woody from Madness's mum. So I I've always been around those guys for years. But I was always terrified. I was a terrible rider. And I was riding, what I didn't know is I was riding on 1966 tires and brakes. I had no idea. And that was, it was just this thing of having a thing that could get you around. I was never into cars. My mum didn't have a car. My dad had a car, but they'd split. So I was locked into Finchley. So as soon as I had this bike, I was out. I could go do what I wanted. And then they changed the 250 law, didn't they? Down to 125.
But did you not go and get your license at that stage then?
I never passed my test. I never did. I don't know why. So I bought a 125 and then I decided, well, I need to make some money. So I became a motorcycle courier.
Oh, yeah.
In Crystal Palace.
Oh, yeah.
That's got to be a good learning curve, though, as learning skills about riding motorcycles.
I had no skills at all.
But you did after that job, I'm sure.
God, no.
Really?
Absolutely liability. So I shelved all that. And I've been a musician doing all this stuff and then I end up in the States and I bought a Harley. I bought a Sportster. My dad had gone to LA to go do Max Headroom, which he'd done in England, and he went and did it out in America. Mm. And I went out there and had a girlfriend there, lived on Laurel Canyon. And then I bought a Harley.
Because that's just what you do in America.
But I bought a Sportster, which was, you know, what I could afford at the time. And they were expensive back then. They were really expensive bikes. It's about $4,000 or something at the time. It was a lot of money. And that was the next level of freedom. And I still didn't really know how to ride. And then I ended up buying a big bagger. And, you know, I had a really bad smash on it. I came off on a patch of diesel and cut my ass wide open, sliding down the road on a pebble. And it was just this thing. I had this weird relationship with bikes where I loved them, but I never really knew how to do them. Yeah. And then it was time, you know, I sold the bike when I had a kid.
That's a very familiar story to a
Absolutely.
Lot of people, isn't it?
Yeah.
I sold it to a guy from Death Row Records who came armed. And at the time he came to my house, there was a guy upstairs from the Aryan Brotherhood who was hiding from the Aryan Brotherhood. I mean, this is insane. My life is insane. He wanted to come inside and do the deal. And they paid me cash in the street. Very, very weird day. So my license plate was M-A-A-A-H-K. Ma.
California riding, though. I mean,
and then they went to no helmet law back then. Yeah.
Well, my best friend, he died in 2010. He crashed a motorcycle. And up until then, like, we'd ride in shorts, flip-flops. We're in southern Spain. It's hot as hell. And we'd have a skull cap on. They're called quitamultas. It was like to get rid of a fine, kind of, in Spanish. And then after the crash, I saw his helmet. And from that day on, I started wearing an open face and wearing gloves. And then I can't ride a motorcycle. Even in the summertime, I can't ride a bike without gloves anymore. I need gloves now.
I went to Sturgis.
I haven't been there yet.
I went to Sturgis years ago. And I went with a mate of mine. And I took a toy hauler. Toy hauler is what they call an RV with a back with bikes in it.
Yeah.
I drove there and took the bikes out. And I discovered I was both too young and too old to be in Sturgis at the same time. And I left after 24 hours. And I actually got a job. I got called and got a job, so I drove home. What I had was I ran a bar in Hollywood, the worst of my drinking, right before I got sober. And that was a bike bar. It's a very famous bike bar. It was the Powerhouse. So me and Gary Twain ran the Powerhouse. And so it was all Harleys and British bikes.
Yeah.
What the most important part of this story is, I'm not going into my entire life story here, is I got to a certain point of security. I got to a certain point with, you know, I'm married, a new baby. And I was like, I want to be riding. I don't know why, it's the best place in the world. The zen of riding on Mulholland takes you away from the stress of being in Los Angeles and the rest of it. You get on a bike and it's just this wonderful feeling. America's very much a car culture, not very much a bike culture in that way. Bike culture in England is because you can't afford a car. You know, Clarkson's great story about the Reliant Robin is because you can drive it on a motorcycle license and the insurance. And that's a brilliant point. Working class transport was what I had. And then I was like, I want a bike. So I bought a Fat Bob in 08. And I was like, yeah, okay, it's not really doing it for me. And then I was like, you know what? I need a Ducati. I've always wanted one. Why have I not bought one?
What was your influence then? Why Ducati?
It was a lot of... No, you know what it was? It was unobtainium. Last year I had... Well, the funny thing is with collectors is that they suddenly realise that you can buy a Daytona for $200,000 and you can fit one in the car space. You can fit seven bikes in that space. Yeah. So I have a very big three-car garage with at one point, what was it, 16 or 17 bikes in there. So I have a 2012 Pikes Peak.
Yeah.
I picked it up at Beverly Hills Ducati because I had to drop my Foggy in to be serviced for something. I said, give me a bike, I've got to go somewhere. And they were like, oh, some German guy left this bike here. So charged the battery, I got on it and I rode it down to Newport Beach. I suddenly realised I was going very, very fast and riding like a hooligan. It was beautiful balance. I mean, compared to the race bikes I have.
It's a very different position as well, isn't it?
Yes. To this day, that's still one of my favourite bikes on the planet. I mean, it's one of those bikes that you can do literally anything. You can take it to a track and be very tasty on a track. You can take it, if you put different tires on it, they make an off-road one.
Yep, if you put Corsa 3s on it, they're incredible. So I then bought a 2008 Monster 1100 that the ex-head of Ducati marketing, who was given it, got every single person to give him stuff. So as Marchesini's, he has everything on it. It has black carbon fiber Termignoni's on it.
Is that the S2 then?
It's not the S2. It's later. So it actually says 1100R on it. It's hand painted and it's one of the top five Munsters in the world. And it's like, it's unrideable. Yeah, there's a 1200R front end on it. No ABS. If I touch the front brake in a corner, I'm dead. But it looks amazing. Exactly. Then I have the prettiest bike in the history of the world that has ever been built. I have a 1998 916 SPS USA R.
Ooh,
I called Ducati and I went, what is it? And they went, I know it's a 996 motor, so it's the last one. It's one of 50 that went to the States. Even though they were numbered 200 and something, it didn't exist. There was 50 of them. And so I have that. I got that with 2,400 miles again on it. And I ride that bike and it is the most beautiful thing I've ever ridden. But I don't think people realise, because here we live in a cold, wet place most of the time. The 4 days of summer make us very, very happy. And I love bikers here. The gear you have to wear, the stuff you have to do, the people that put their heart and soul in it. Doesn't matter if you're riding a Pooch Maxi or whether you're riding a Super. It's like, it's you and it's down to you. It's the closest thing to a horse in the weirdest way. I remember riding a motorcycle on a freeway once and looking down and going, there's actually nothing there, and I'm in it. That's the other thing about Ducatis that I love more than almost any other bike. I mean, there's a lot of wonderful bikes, but you're in it. You're not on it. You're in it. No matter what Ducati you have, you are literally in that bike. It's a sexy machine. It's always been a sexy machine. They've always had that ability to do it, and the sound is like no other machine.
I had Motorcycling Nirvana in the Great British Isles last year. It is possible. I rode from Cornwall, from the Lizard Peninsula, the most southerly point of Cornwall, to the most northerly point of Scotland. 6 days, not a drop of rain.
It's the thing of, I live in a city which is built on a grid system and has freeways going through it and terrible traffic. And you get on a bike and you go,
that's one thing about in LA, every time I get to LA, the first thing I do is get a bike. But being in a car, just everywhere it took, a 10-minute drive was 40 minutes or an hour or something.
Every one of my Ducatis has race pipes on them, right? And so if I'm splitting lanes on the 405, all the CHP guys will pull in behind me because their bikes are too quiet to split lanes properly. Yeah. They'll literally tuck in with me and I'll gun it. They don't care.
Plus on the 405, you've got that carpool lane and then you've got that massive wide berth in between that lane and the next line. So you can pin down there. Like one day I was going along there and all of a sudden this bike pulls up beside me and it's a cop, right? And he just looks over at me and he's like, slow it down. Yeah, he just gives me the slow it down. And I'm like, okay. So I back off the throttle a little bit and he just carries on flying. I've only met cool cops in LA.
Did he have a mustache?
He did.
He did. It's probably a friend of mine, MC. No, I'm dead serious. My buddy MC is one of the coolest CHP bike riders. He's a real chippy and he's a wonderful human being and one of my favorite people on the planet and a very, very brave man. He got into some difficulty in a street racing, breaking up a street racing gang that he got killed. His partner got killed. But he's the guy that goes, I'm not going to give you a ticket unless you're an asshole.
Knock on wood, to this day, I've never run into a bad cop in LA.
But look, there's an artificial idea of what it's like over there. There's an artificial idea of fame. What it comes down to, it's funny, like I'm here to do a convention. And people have opinions about conventions and people that go to conventions. There's something really fascinating about this, is that when you make television with like 150 of your friends, and then they take it into post-production and they mess with it, and then somebody scores it and they do whatever, and you don't go to people's houses and watch it with them. So you never actually see your audience. It's not like live theater or live music, which is what I come from. So if I go to a convention, I get that audience back. I get the audience back. And if I go to a guest talk and I'm messing with them and I'm having fun, not just sitting on a stage, somebody going, so what was it like on episode 3? It's genuinely people going, which did you prefer, doing this or that? How did you do this? And I'm walking around, I'm hugging babies and throwing stuff. I'm literally back in live entertainment for something that is always pre-recorded. So I adore it. It is my favorite thing. Matt Smith says, like, isn't it a bit weird? Isn't, you know, all these people. I said, mate, you come from playing football to live theater. You will love every second of it. You'll have thousands of people coming up to you telling you they love you and why. And it's the greatest feeling in the world. I said, you'll do this and then you'll sleep for 3 days because you'll be emotionally exhausted after.
Yeah. It's interesting getting into music and having that audience feedback. Was that
120,000 people at Croke Park? Yeah.
Was that what hooked you? Was it about the music, or was a big part of it the adulation? And
no, you'll get this if you really think about it. I know you'll get it because it impacts all of you. It's the telling of stories. It's the participation in the telling of stories. Doesn't matter if you're going to do Long Way Round. It's the telling of a story that you want to tell.
It's performance as well, isn't it? You're engaging people, like getting on stage and playing your music. You go in theatre for a play, or there's often a little vomit bucket beside, and then everything's forgotten. A bit like riding a motorbike.
Yes.
You know, you go on stage and you forget about everything, and then same thing with a motorbike.
You want to speak about nerves, so... 2 weeks ago, I wrote and performed my very first stand-up gig at a packed theater at the Leicester Comedy Festival, and I've never felt nothing like it. But I tell you what, as soon as it was like go time, they call my name, everyone starts clapping, you walk out on stage.
Last clap ego.
But I got up there, did my set. Okay, I forgot. So the nerves kind of kicked in, and I tried to relax as much as I could. So I forgot about a minute of my set, but no one else knew. I came off and I was just like shaking for about another half an hour. And I just went downstairs and everyone's like, how was it? I'm like, when's the next gig? Nice. And then on Sunday I called and I said, hey, do you want to close the Leicester Comedy Festival? There's the very last gig of the comedy festival. So I went down, jumped in my car. So I thought, okay, well, I'll just add a bit more material to the beginning of the set. And it went well. You know, the first bit, the ad-libbed bit I threw in there went really well. But what happened? It took me completely off of what my material. So for a second there, I kind of froze. I'm like, and I felt the nerves coming up and the sweat. And I just kind of like, I just thought, say something. So I just went on. I was just like, you know, I shouldn't have done all those drugs back in the 90s. It clearly affected my memory. But that kind of got a laugh. And then we started talking. And then one woman in the crowd, she's like, no, you were talking about this suitcase. And then I started going down the front line. I'm like, what about you, sir? What do you remember? You? And I kind of played with the crowd for a little bit. So I completely saved it, finished my set. I came off feeling so much better. I learned something from that. I failed, but I saved it.
I've got friends who are stand-up comics, well-known stand-up comics, and you have to know what it is to die. It's like crashing on a bike, although it's an awful thing to say. You don't know the limits of your bike till you fall over.
Well, look, I always say, like, if you look at Marquez, the reason that boy would crash was because he'd get on that bike and he'd do as many laps as he could, get to the limit and go, okay, I've got a bit more. And then he would push the limit, crash, and go, okay, I need to back it off 2%. And now I know the absolute limit of my bike.
And how did he do last season?
Yeah.
Okay. So moving on.
You need to crash and burn to learn.
But there's an arrogance to Marquez, which is earned. It's what makes them so special, because they're playing in an area that everyone thinks they know, but nobody's ever been there. The G-forces on Hamilton, the G-forces on the boys in MotoGP bikes. I'm looking at them, they're like, would you like to ride a MotoGP bike around? I'm like, no, I do not want to ride around Mugello on a MotoGP bike.
The Nod is proudly supported by the British Motorcycle Insurance Company, a new digital-first insurance platform built for the good of the rider community. Sign up as a rider to join their waiting list or register your interest as a community partner on the website, thebmic.co.uk. This is insurance powered by the people. It is insurance for riders built on community. Insurance is the ultimate grudge purchase. The British Motorcycle Insurance Company wants to filter out the things that slow riders down so you can focus on what you love. Community-based, transparent and digital, the next generation of motorcycle insurance. Can I change tack slightly? We kind of talk about well-being, and bikes are good for us because it brings people together, it opens conversations. Sometimes it's an outlet when things are stressful. It's kind of, you know, in your life, is it an escapism for you? What is it in your life?
Well, I don't know how English this is, but residing in America, I'm very, very open and very public about my mental health issues. My wife is very public about her mental health issues. And the show that I was on for years is a show called Supernatural, which was shown all over the world, very, very
popular. Yeah, very popular.
And the themes of that show were about family, togetherness, brotherhood, always keep fighting. And so we, not to make it sound too odd, but there's an awful lot of people in the world who found a lot of solace and comfort in the themes of that show. And when they started coming together, we had a, I hate the word fan because fan's short for fanatic. It implies something wrong with people. Mm. And there is not. To be a lover of something is everything in life. To have passion for something is the most important thing in the world. I don't trust people who aren't passionate or care about something. I don't trust people who aren't actually fans of something. It's a sad life without it. But these people tended to come together, and with these conventions, which almost became lifestyle events, is you see an incredible healing power of people looking after each other. The greatest place to have an anxiety attack is a Supernatural convention, because 50 people will come up and try to help you, and then one person will say, stand back, you're crowding them, and they will actually get you to that. So I'm seeing, you know, I've been sober 33 years, and I've seen what Alcoholics Anonymous can do as a group for people. And, you know, we can talk about gangs and brotherhoods and sisterhoods and all these things that come together, which are important in people's lives. The way the world is right now, it's a scary place. It's become very individualistic. It's become less community than any other time in our history. On this
very
planet.
Polarized.
It's incredibly polarized. But the saddest thing, I think, is as a man, and talking as man, the company of men for a man is the most essential thing for my mental health. The idea of being able to share and find other people's experiences is what saved my life in so many ways. People that went before me, to have elders, to have people, your dad, for example, to be, you know, to the possibility of sitting down and having a conversation with a man who had an imprint on my idea of how to make films. I direct. I'm an actor and I direct, and he changed my life. By proxy, my love of his love of what he does. Mm. And I see it, and not to toot your horn too much, I see it in you too, I just won't tell you. But your love of what you do, the passion that you do, is definitely in the same vein as your father's passion for what it is that he's done. And that's very British to not be able to take that compliment in a true way. But you, when you do something, you care. But our job is to bring people with us. Our job is to help and be kind and be nice in a world that is just fundamentally selfish and nasty like it's never been before. And then you add, you know, be it unemployment, be it inflation, which is terrifying in this country right now. It's not affecting us in America quite the same way. It is affected, but not the same way it is here. And the pandemic and everything that began, and the polarization, forgetting about anybody's politics, what I'm talking about, I'm talking about rights and wrongs, whatever. But the way people treat people, the amount of people screaming in people's faces.
The division, this is.
But there's no real division. It's almost like we've been told to be angry, and everybody having all these stuffed feelings. And it sounds ridiculous. And this is not brain surgery we're talking about here. But the shared experiences with motorcycles, the shared experiences with traveling together, the shared experience with having dreams, having the idea, saving up to buy an R6, and then having the R6 and being with a bunch of guys that have an R6, or you're the first guy to get the R6. It's a different world. It changes your entire perspective. Having people to hang out with, the bike shed, you know, a fundamental idea of a gathering spot. It's fundamental in this world that we care for each other. Love is the, it sounds so corny. Love is the only antidote to all of this. It's all it is. And love and passion are all synonymous. Showing off, bragging, trying, competing, all those things done in a kind environment are wonderful for the soul. And I think bikes are a great equalizer for that.
within your life and your friendship group, how does that manifest itself? How do you go about spreading that love, being that support, empowering people around you to have these conversations?
You open your eyes, you open your heart, and you look. And if you see somebody struggling, or you see somebody, just something's off, your gut tells you immediately. And that's when you put your hand out and you go, "How you doing?" Or "Hi." I've talked down to people. I don't know what it's not. I'm not special. It's just I don't know any other way to live comfortably. I try not to be kind. I try to be tough. I try, you know, I'm covered in tattoos. I try to be a particular thing. But the truth is, I'm only happy. Sorry, this is the easiest way. I used to think I felt love by receiving love. The man who was my sponsor for a long time in AA was a man called Hubert Selby Jr. He wrote Last Exit to Brooklyn. Requiem for a Dream. Happy stories. Mm. He used to describe himself as a scream looking for a mouth, which is kind of an interesting phrase. He taught me, not by telling me, but just by showing me, that the only way I feel love is by giving love.
Yeah.
And that's it. So whether you're providing a service, whether you're providing a place for people to feel comfortable and at home, but not in an elitist way, not in a if you have enough money way, or not if you have the right bike way, or, you know, I've got a Ferrari club. Well, there's not going to be that many people in the Ferrari club, is there? But it's the idea that come one, come all, which is so fundamentally British and so fundamentally Irish, actually, the spirit of community, which is seems to have been taken from us in by circumstance. Yeah. I don't know if I'm going off on a tangent here.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think the way news is broadcasted as well, it's all done in small, angry bites, and it's sort of shouted at you. And this polarization of politics now as well, of not being able to have a normal conversation anymore about politics, because either you're one way or the other.
But I think we've been told that, so it makes it even more polarizing.
Yeah,
I think
exactly.
The fact is that you and I could have a conversation about politics, whatever your politics, I don't know what they are, and you don't know what mine are. But as I've sat in the South talking to fundamentally opposed political people, pastors in certain areas, I know a lot of people in the political world, certainly in America, and we agree on 98% of everything. It's the implementation we argue about. And that's what it is. And if you're not willing to share, I mean, like, you've done TV shows and you've done things to bring people to something, right? You're trying to entertain. You're trying to, but you're trying to open the mind to something. I mean, I'm supposedly in the pure entertainment world. I go out there and I play in the fantasy world. I'm in Battlestar Galactica. I'm in Firefly. I'm in all these great fantasy shows that have always existed. But we're all in the same game, which is we're trying to have people, we're trying to make enjoyment for people. And we're being told and taught to be protectionists, stay in this world. You know, video games, TV's changed, films have changed. You can't, you know, your dad can't make the films.
Well, Dad has just done this thing with BAFTA and stuff that is that you can't call them films anymore. Because they're not filmed on celluloid.
No.
So they're not films, they're movies.
But hey, so I would argue with him actually saying somebody had a brilliant argument with me is actually, you know that celluloid is actually a digital medium because it's silver halide crystals.
Yes, on or off. Well,
it's actually low res. All it is low res digital.
We get technical about it. But film, you have to light the stage. You can't.
Do anything
afterwards. You can't do anything post, really.
I worked at 17 years old editing with one of the most famous editors in England. I've handled making 90-foot dissolves with a Chinagraph pencil and a thing. I mean, I grew up with that love of that medium, that it takes time and it takes effort.
Yeah. Do you remember all the bags full of pieces of celluloid just sitting there that you're splicing together?
But there are no apprenticeships.
No, there's nothing. Because you can just learn it on internet. No.
Who teaches you how to ride an R6 when you buy the R6? Where is it that your mates, and unless you've got a group of mates who are inclusive and everybody's doing good and it's like, we'll show you how to get... You need mentors. You need that to have good mental health. You need that.
Across society now, like when I was a kid, when I was, you know, 16, I got kicked out of school. And
quite rightly so.
Yeah.
And whose fault was that?
Not mine, of course.
Of course.
So I go home and I sit around the house the next day. My mom's like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, well, I've got nowhere to go. I got no school. She goes, well, you're not sitting around the house. You're either going to find another school or you're going to work. There's only two choices here. And so I'm like, well, I'm going to go to work. So I went to work with my dad, and he's a machinist, tool and die maker. And so I started an apprenticeship with him. I was like, okay, I'm going to earn some money. And I started off, you know, my first day on the job, I had a broom. And for probably a month, I swept and mopped the factory. That's the only thing I was allowed to touch. But the thing is, like, I'm very good with a mop and a broom, which not many people are these days. But
you're starting to sound like an old man here, Andy. You know that, don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, like, you know, I got a file and I was allowed to deburr things, and then I could go into the drill press, and I had to do an apprenticeship.
Now, because everything's on the internet. Exactly. Now, because everything's immediate.
But nobody wants. Everyone's an nobody expert. Wants to do an apprenticeship.
But everybody goes to university now.
Well, AI will write it for you now.
And AI will write it for you. But in Switzerland and other countries in Europe now, the apprenticeship is still very strong. So if you want to go into the watch industry, if you want to be a trader or something like that, to do an apprenticeship. And so in Germany, and my mum comes from, my mum was German. I used to go over there. Do you speak any Deutsch?
They know each other.
Why do you know my mother? Hang on a minute.
Hold on.
We're related. We're related. So there is the culture of that.
Yes.
In Europe and stuff, because they manufacture. Here, we don't do that anymore.
But that was a great British tradition.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like if you weren't going to be an academic, you had to learn a trade, right. And it was called a trade.
Well, that's why we moved to Canada, because in 1982, there was a massive lack.
1982, I was shooting heroin. It's like a very weird thing to remember.
In 82.
I was in Algeria in 1982.
In Algeria, shooting heroin.
No, I did it before I went.
We went there.
France.
That's how you ended up in Algeria.
In a prison.
No, that's Billy Hayes, who I also went with, and that was Turkey. That's a long story.
That's another story. Yeah.
But so in 82, when we moved to Canada, we only moved there because Australia was offering the same. In Australia and in Canada, there was a lack of skilled tradesmen, and they had no... You know, they had this massive need for industry and no tradesmen. So that's why there's so many Brits, Scots, Welsh... in Canada, in Australia, because all these skilled tradesmen.
You know, I used to live in Canada, and my wife's Australian.
I didn't know about the Canadian part.
Well, I did Supernatural there for 8 years.
Toronto.
Vancouver.
Vancouver. Well, actually, Vancouver's a nice place. I like Vancouver.
And I've been going up there since first season X-Files. I was the fire guy. The hurricane started fires in his mind. I love Canada, and I love Canadians. It's just, if it's such a wonderful country, why they all live within 10 miles of America? Just joking.
Listen, Canada's I don't live there. I left in 99. I love going 99. Home to Canada.
My oldest was born in 99.
We're probably running out of tape at the moment. My editor's going to charge me double. That was great.
No, thank you for being open.
But it's the truth.
Yeah.
I don't know that you know is that I have the opportunity to do that more than most people. Mm. Like Ewan couldn't do it because there's an overwhelming sense of him being an untouchable and above something. Mm. There's a very strange sense of my celebrity, but people feel that they know that I'm an honest person and I talk about these things. And I've done it to hundreds of thousands of people. And I don't profess or do. And it's the conversations with individuals in public settings that change things. Mm. Like a girl getting up and asking, are there a lot of options for autistic crew members in your business? And I'm like, okay, you're autistic, so let's have a conversation. And just including the rest of an audience with it. You know, autism is such a wide diagnosis. Is that the be-all and end-all of your argument here? Or what do we, and you have
well, a lot of it is help, isn't it?
Yes.
A lot of it is people need help. I get a lot of... I'm very dyslexic, and I've turned up in places, and a mother has driven 10 hours across Australia to say hello, to tell her son that it's okay to be a dyslexic. And,
that's brilliant.
You know, and so you sit there and you have a chat and you say, look, it is okay to... And we all are a little bit different, but... You know,
but there's a power in that, and that's again the sense of community, which is what that's about. No, I mean, you're all linked together by crashing motorcycles. So
actually, Charlie and I linked together through having testicular cancer.
Yeah,
that's how we met. Yeah, I had it twice.
I met two.
So.
He's got not anymore.
You've got some both.
Yeah,
we've got three between us.
My favourite thing is I was being manhandled by a gentleman, and I said, "So, what made you want to be a PP doctor?" And he goes, "You really want to know?" And I said, "Yeah." Because you're not going to buy me dinner, you might as well have this conversation. And he said, I used to be an ER doctor. I was sick of watching people die. You come to me, I can fix anything you got.
I was like, wow.
It is. It is. It's all about prevention. And we met. I can't remember how we met, but anyway, we became friends. And then we got involved with Movember. And we both tell our story. And we were, JC used to introduce us as One Night.
You know, there's the wax company called One Ball. One Ball J. One Ball J is a surfboard wax.
But it does make you feel a little bit, well, when you've got one left, it's like when you've got one eye left. My dad, you know, you start to think, oh, I've only got one eye.
My father had one eye. And he played first class cricket. I mean, that's terrifying. Oh, he had no 3D.
Depth of perception.
He played first class cricket.
One of my best mates when we were young, he was a psychopath. He came back from the army and he was a proper alcoholic, tattooed.
Canadian.
And he tried to kill himself one night years ago, but didn't do it. And he went to the hospital. He was fine, but lost an eye. And he had a Ninja 600. And one night we're drinking, and he'd always show up on a bike. None of us had bikes back then, and he'd always come up on his bike and come by us. And he'd come around this corner by my buddy Ryan's house, and he'd just lift the front wheel up and just go by us, one wheel. Case of beer tucked under his one arm and just go, wow, one eye, go straight past his.
I knew a guy that just stuck a 12 gauge in his mouth and pulled the trigger and didn't die. But he spent a lot of time walking around talking to people about it, which was incredible.
Well, you know, isn't it something like 80% of suicides are failures?
That's the one thing. I've contemplated many times killing myself. But the thing is, I would never be sure. Because my issue is not wanting to die, it's not knowing how to live. And that's a massive difference, mental health-wise.
And people, you know, I've had a couple of friends who took their lives and truly believed it was a better thing. And what's really sad about it is that I still think about him. I mean, he lost his life in our 20s.
Wow.
And I still think about him 2 or 3 times a week. Sometimes I go to parties and I know that he would be...
He would have been there. Yeah.
And we would have had a good time together, but... You know, so
it's, I'm missing a lot of friends.
But I think Keanu Reeves said it. He said that would anybody miss you? You know, when you died, and you think, well, actually, I would hope that the people who love me would miss me.
I can't stand the devastation that it causes. I'm not talking about the mental health aspect. I'm not talking about people in distress. I'm not talking about what people deserve, how they deserve to be helped. Mm-hmm. But the pure selfishness of the destruction that it causes for the family you leave behind is the most painful and terrifying thing. And I get it. I understand it. I totally understand it. And I've been sober for 33 years. I've seen a lot of people not make it. I knew a kid who the most violent way to kill himself. I've never seen anything or heard anything like it in my life. He knotted an electric flex, plugged it in and swallowed it.
How much pain would he have been in? No, I mean, not pain as in his death, but how much pain in himself to get to that point? I'm so grateful for my two girls who are 26 and 27 now, who have managed to get through without having insanity, because school can be an awfully cruel place.
Yeah. I've got a seven-year-old. I've got a seven-year-old daughter. Oh. And she's smarter than... She is smarter than the rest. She's funny. So you have a bad day.
I was going to say that wouldn't be difficult, but
pretty smart.
But no, but she's got, you know, she's got parents like you though, which is that navigate through all this new life.
The meanness. My boys are talking to me about dating. Yeah. 23 and 17.
Yeah.
My God, we wouldn't have survived what they're doing now. It's insane.
Yeah. Oh no, but they do this thing about they change their status on their Instagram or Twitter. They're available, open, or they're whatever, or they're going steady, or they're.
That was 5 years ago. Now they're sending documents to each other before they touch each other. My son probably would not engage in an interpersonal relationship with somebody without getting them tested and him getting tested. Mm. I mean, that's not the 70s. Yeah, that's not the art. The sociological aspects right now, not being definitive about it, but saying the idea that there's power in withdrawing sexuality, but over displaying sexuality, which is, I'm a father of a girl. And I'm like, where do you go with this? There's more tits and Instagram and TikTok stuff going on. And yet there's this huge backlash against.
But it's this fakeness. It's the way everybody seems to think that they can take a photo and make it feel that it's so important that they take a photo of themselves every day.
My 12-year-old daughter, she's come off TikTok. She's unloaded it. Mm. She looks at Pinterest.
It's way smarter.
But have you seen?
But it's you can sit there. We've all done it. Sat there and you're flicking through things, and you're looking. Well, there's only 45 minutes later. And you sit there thinking, well, I can't remember anything that I just watched.
Well, that's what it's all designed to do. Yeah. You know what I mean? That's the whole sole purpose of all of those apps, is to keep you on it as long as
possible.
But
it's actually possible, 6 seconds.
Right?
And that's an impact of how we make TV shows and movies now.
It's changed the cut.
And it's changed the cut.
The old story used to be, the old film story used to be, you would have to show 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Then you'd have to show the doors to the Oval Office, see the president sitting in the wide. Mm. You'd have to come into him sitting at the table signing something. Mm. And then you would go down to the pen. Mm. Now you go, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, pen.
Pen, yeah.
You've literally taken out all the interstitials.
And the way you write and the way you edit, and then you've got to deal with kids now watching TV, and they're watching TV and they're sitting on their phones at the same time watching it.
But you still have kids, Better Call Saul. You still have things that you go like, oh my God, they didn't know what he was doing. It's brilliant. It's because you always, Sopranos or whatever it is that you want. I did Battlestar, which 50 years from now will still be one of the greatest sci-fi stories ever done, which has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It was never cancelled. Those things endure. Art always endures. There's always this horrible push towards crap. Like, the old days, going into a studio to make a record would cost you $100,000, $200,000, $300,000.
Well,
you go residential, now you do it in your living room.
Yeah.
Actually, literally, my son's credit on the new album is Daddy's Basement. Mm. We've got nice gear, so. But it just because you have the tools doesn't mean they're used well.
And there's always something that's going to go against the flow and pop out and be something that is seminal and more.
I just realised there's something really analogue about motorcycles. It's probably why I don't like the idea of electric bikes, even though they're fantastic.
Well, that's because you're 35 plus. Funny enough, for anyone who's sort of 35 below, it's people who are sort of 35 plus who still...
It's romanticism.
Romanticism and what you're used to. And people don't like change. People don't like, people are afraid of change.
630 horsepower V12 hand-built motor. They will never build that engine ever again. It will never be built again. And it's a 2021.
Ian Callum, who up until recently was the chief designer for Jag, and he's done all sorts of stuff. And I saw him at the weekend, and we did the Mille Mille together, and we were both in D-types. And it was lovely. But he felt that he's probably designed probably his last combustion engine car.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, he had such an influence on Aston.
Anyway, we digress to something else. As the chief inspector, do you want to do the clothes? Yeah, have you got a close?
Oh, I haven't really written it, to be honest.
You're going
to
wing it?
Yeah, I might just... Yeah. I mean, there's about four episodes in this somewhere on all different subject matters. But, Mark, I mean, it's amazing to meet you. I'm inspired to hear about your passion for bikes and Ducatis, and just your outlook on life is refreshing and totally aligned with where we're all coming from. And I think if we can all continue to speak openly in the manner that you do, we can, continue to create a happy world where people feel safe and empowered and can live their best lives. So
changing things one person at a time is everything. It really is.
Thank you for listening to The Nod, a mindful motorcycle podcast. I hope you've enjoyed this week's episode. Do make sure you subscribe to get your alerts and share the show to help us grow. You can also follow us on Instagram at The Nod Pod. And a big thanks to our friends and sponsors at Babel Cover. Do check them out online and join the community. We will be back next week with another guest who we'll be hitting the road with and having a chat. Join us next time, and until then, stay safe, be kind, and check in with a mate.